It's the holiday season, and if you're anything like me, you're getting solicitations every day in the mail and in the email asking for your year-end contribution to those worthy causes that you have supported. So let's look at how the whole world of charity works in this country. Charities may operate with the noblest of intentions, but according to our next guest, Dan Pallotta, they are hampered from the very start by an irrational set of rules and assumptions, by barring or discouraging charities from, he says, wielding the most effective tools of capitalism, sorts of incentives, ways of practicing. We limit their ability to fight the social problems and help those who in need that they were formed to tackle on a significant scale. Where other folks often suggest ways to optimize performance inside the existing paradigm of nonprofits and charities, and there's plenty of studies and books and all of that, Dan's book, Uncharitable, suggests that that paradigm itself is the problem and calls into question our fundamental beliefs about charity. And one thing I'm going to note before I even bring Dan on is that in speaking to Ethan Nadelman about the drug war, he referred to the fact that in some ways it's become like a religion that you don't question. And Dan Pallotta makes the same point about the way we look at nonprofits and charities. Dan Pallotta founded Pallotta Teamworks, which created and ran the AIDS rides and the multi-day breast cancer walks. These events under his direction raised over $500 million in 9 years and netted for the charities over $300 million. He's the author, as I said, of Uncharitable, How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine the Potential. Welcome, Dan Pallotta.
Hi, Terry. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me. It's with a short O, Pallotta.
Oh, okay. My mistake.
No problem.
Okay. I like listeners to get to know the people behind the work and the ideas. So before you were thinking about a book like this about how to change a charity, what got you involved in that world in the first place?
You know, it started when I was in college. I was in charge of the Hunger Action Committee, and we used to do these puny little fundraisers for Oxfam. And I thought, geez, we're capable of doing something much bigger. So I organized a bike ride across the United States, and 40 of us pedaled 4,200 miles from Seattle to Boston to raise a lot more money and a lot more awareness for Oxfam. And then I moved to California, and in the early 90s, I started losing a lot of friends to AIDS. And it was a similar dynamic. There was nothing big that you could do. You could buy a red ribbon. You could go to a black tie chicken dinner, but you were burying your friends, and you needed something, a much bigger expression of your grief and your compassion. So I came up with the idea of these long journeys and asked, you know, why are walkathons always so short? Why are bike-a-thons always so short? Let's create seven-day bike rides and three-day walks and, you know, these incredible tent cities where people will stay overnight and build community and raise huge amounts of money at the same time. And as we were building that business and becoming more and more successful, I noticed a lot of irrational criticism. Okay, we're spending a lot of money on advertising, and that's bringing in huge numbers of participants, and they're raising millions and millions of dollars, but people don't like us buying advertising. That's a counterproductive idea. We're investing money in the quality of the event so that people have a great experience, so that they'll talk to their friends about it, and we'll get even more people to do it. People are criticizing us because they want to see more of the money go to charity in the short term, but I'm saying to myself, yeah, but that's going to mean less money going to charity in the long term. So I just noticed that we have a separate rule book for charity that prohibits all of the tools of capitalism that make businesses huge. So that's where the impetus for the book came from.
Right, and so the impetus for charity came from the impulse to do something good, and your time in the world of charity led to the impetus to make a charity work better. This is Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Dan Pallotta. If I can do with you what I threatened to do, which is basically ask you three questions. The first one is the way that we fund charities and nonprofits in the country broken?
Well, the way we fund them isn't broken, but what we let them do with the funds is broken. And let me briefly explain. We have two rule books. one for charity and one for the rest of the economic world. So we let people make huge amounts of money in business, but we don't want people making any money in charity. And so that means that none of the most talented leadership coming out of the best business schools in the country is willing to go into the nonprofit sector. The salary cuts are too enormous. So they go into the for-profit sector, and causes like AIDS and breast cancer and poverty lose their talents until they're 65 or 70 years old and they've made all their money and they decide they want to start a foundation.
Now, let me ask something in that. We read and hear that the sense of service, the sense of volunteering, participating in the civil society is stronger than ever on college campuses. And I spoke to the folks who'd written about the millennials recently, so that's really the case with them. Is what you're saying that before they have responsibilities, before they have to take care of families and so on, they do this sort of thing, then the best of them leave it, make business, security, money, advancement their primary goal, charity, if they have the time and the resources, and then be returned to it again in their senior years?
Yeah, absolutely. And I talk to a lot of young people, you know, in their mid-20s who realize they're facing a mutually exclusive choice. Should I go to work in charity or should I go into the corporate world? I really want to live in a nice apartment. I want to get married. I want to have kids. You know, where am I going to send my kids to school? So all of these concerns come up, and you know, it's very debilitating, and we force them into the for-profit sector. It's irrational. We allow people to make huge amounts of money doing any number of things that will hurt the poor, but want to crucify anyone who wants to try and do something that will help them. You know, you want to make $1 million selling violent video games to kids? Go for it. You want to make $1 million trying to find a cure for cancer? You're a parasite. I mean, the illogic of that is breathtaking.
Yeah, and one of the things I think you point out is that it even within the nonprofit world or the charitable world, there's sort of classes or castes. In other words, if you are going to run a college or a symphony or a very large foundation, you can make pretty good money, a big museum.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's when the images of the needy come into the picture that we get emotional and we lose sight of the end outcome. So, you know, I think there were something like 23 college football coaches working at nonprofit colleges that made over $1 million last year. The conductor for the New York Philharmonic a couple of years ago got paid $2 million for a 14-week stint. But can you imagine if the head of a hunger charity were getting paid $2 million? We then look at it as a zero-sum game. That $2 million, we think, is coming away from people who are poor and people who are needy. Well, that's not the way that the for-profit sector looks at their investment in a CEO. If that CEO for $2 million can raise 30 times more than someone you might be paying $250,000, aren't you only doing a disservice to the needy if you eliminate those kinds of people from the market? And oughtn't the needy have a say in how much should be invested in the people that can really advance the causes that will help them?
Now, let me just ask you a couple of questions, which I sort of assume. One is that we're obviously seeing at this moment revelations of enormous excess in the corporate world, especially the financial world. My guess is that there are people in the not-for-profit world who are not worth what they're making. But what you're saying is that those individual cases, fine. People should not necessarily go into charity because of greed. But that it's what you're talking about is a whole paradigm, a whole perspective, a whole way of thinking.
Yeah, I'm not in favor of gratuitously paying people in charity more money. What I'm saying is instead of focusing on what somebody makes, we should focus on what we want to accomplish. Do we want to end hunger? Then let's ask, what kind of a person would we need to end hunger? What kind of person would we need to end poverty in Los Angeles? And let's find that person, and let's pay that person whatever we need. But the apartheid goes way beyond executive compensation. In fact, that's, you know, that's relatively minor compared to the other discriminations vis-a-vis...
Right, remember, yeah, the question right now is, how is the current system broken?
Right. And
so we've talked about executive compensation, and you're using that really as a placeholder for the kinds of people that are going to be able to get involved.
Yeah, the kind of leadership and losing all of this top talent to the sale of golf balls and Budweiser instead of curing cancer. Next is we let the for-profit sector advertise until the last dollar produces a penny of value. But we don't want our donated dollars spent on paid advertising and charity. Well, advertising is how you build demand for products and for causes. So if we prohibit the nonprofit sector from advertising, they can't build demand. They can't take market share away from the for-profit sector. And that's why giving in America has remained constant at about 2% of GDP for the last 30 years. So charity is not gaining market share. Challenge you to, open the LA Times this morning, and I'm sure you'll find full-page ads for Macy's and Nordstrom's and Singular and BMW, but you're not going to find a full-page ad for Darfur or for AIDS. You know, the Super Bowl, you're going to see ads for Budweiser and Geico, but you're not going to see an ad for curing cancer or eradicating poverty.
Now let me ask you, if you can, the principle makes sense. Can you give me evidence that advertising, if it's been used, does help charities and nonprofits improve market share?
Absolutely. The work that we did at Pilata Teamworks is solid evidence and a huge experiment. We raised $500 million in 8 years, more money raised more quickly for AIDS and breast cancer than any private event operation in history, and we did it all through advertising. I'll tell you, the first time we did it was in New York when we started the Boston-New York AIDS ride. And I'm saying to myself, God, how are we going to penetrate the New York market and the Boston market? And we decided to run a full-page ad in the Sunday edition of the New York Times, in the second page of the arts and leisure section. At the time, I think it cost us $50,000, and people gasped. You know, how dare you spend $50,000?
Right, you haven't raised a penny yet.
I haven't raised a penny. How dare you spend $50,000? Well, that ad brought in 2,000 phone calls, 1,000 people registered for the event out of that. They each raised an average of $2,000. So we raised $2 million as a result of the placement of a $50,000 ad. When the consumer goes out into the world, they're pummeled with ads for consumer products. And John Kenneth Galbraith wrote a great deal about this, that the marketing engines of the consumer brands are what creates the demand for these products, and how ridiculous it is that we value private good over public good. Well, if we would start to advertise and market public good, imagine if you went out into the world today, you read the paper, and there was an ad for Save the Children, and there was an ad for the Liberty Hill Foundation, and there was an ad for Oxfam America, and then you went to the Grove, and there was a store for Amnesty International, and there was a store for the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation. Imagine if you flipped things and you were pummeled with messages for doing social good. Well, even if we were only to increase that market share from 2% of GDP to 4% of GDP, we would double the amount of charitable giving in the country, and we could actually start to solve some problems. And
yeah, okay, so you can actually say there is evidence. So it's not just a theory. There's evidence that if you are willing to advertise, and you got to do it well, you got to do it smart, and all of that. You can waste money advertising. Everybody can, but it can actually have a huge sort of leveraged amount that what you spend can be well worth it. Other evidence that the charitable system is broken.
Well, there are five areas. We've covered competitive compensation, advertising. Then there's the area of risk. We don't mind if Paramount makes a $100 million movie that flops. Their business model is nonlinear. They have flops. They have successes. That's how they turn a profit. But God forbid you should attempt a charity event that raises $5 million and doesn't turn a 75% profit year one. People want the Attorney General to investigate. So charities are petrified of trying any kind of large-scale revenue-generating experiments, and they can't develop the kinds of learning curves that the for-profit sector can for generating revenue. And it's also ridiculous that we want to measure charity in 12-month increments.
I just written down short-term profits.
Yeah, short-term profit. Now look at, you know, Amazon. We let Amazon go for 6 years without a profit in order to build market dominance, and everybody thought that was a really smart strategy. Can you imagine if a charity went for 6 years raising money to build market dominance or cause dominance without any money during that period going to the needy? We would demand a crucifixion. So there's no way that charities can take big risks to generate revenues, and there's no way they can do long-term planning, because we want our money spent immediately to meet the needs of the needy, and all that means is that the needy are going to be with us for an awful long time.
Getting whatever they can get each year versus a model that says we're going to sow seeds and harvest a lot in 5 years or 10 years or something like that. So, for example,
we would try an event, say, for an AIDS vaccine in Africa, and it wasn't an issue that was nearly as popular as breast cancer, so we couldn't get as many participants, so there wouldn't be as much money, but we'd have the same fixed cost. So that would mean a smaller percentage of the money was going to, say, research for an AIDS vaccine than for breast cancer. Well, people wanted to cut our heads off. How dare only 35% of this money go to AIDS vaccine research? Well, if that's the attitude, then you can't do anything for AIDS vaccine research.
Let me ask you a question, as if not a devil's advocate, maybe a devil's advocate's advocate or something. But might it also be that if you were a for-profit charitable event organizer, which you were, correct?
Right.
Yeah. So Pallada would make a profit, but they would say, we're going to deliver for you, and it's going to be worth it. If you were trying to start a new business within your business, or a new product, which is the AIDS vaccine in Africa one, that you would reduce, you couldn't reduce all your fixed costs, but you would reduce your profit cost, how much you would expect to make from that, because you knew that you were also investing in creating a new market. That makes sense to me. Is that what you did?
Yeah, we did do that in the case of the AIDS vaccine rides. In fact, we didn't charge a fee for any of those events in the year 2002, but that's such a small part of the expenditure that it doesn't have a big impact. You know, your big impact is on, your big expenditures are on advertising mm-hmm. and marketing.
Right, and so what they were saying is it's foolish to advertise and market. Look, we only got, as you say, even you did return money, you just returned a smaller percentage. Let's talk about that, because I think my next question would be, how did it get broken? And one of the key things, we'll let you get to the history in a moment, because I think your story of the history is fascinating, but something that I'm sure people who are listening are thinking about is this thing of efficiency, that the sort of the number one metric that everyone has been taught to use if they are asked to contribute to a charity is how much of every dollar that comes in the door goes for services.
Yeah, this is fascinating. We have been taught to ask the wrong question. In fact, we couldn't be asking a worse question. We have been taught to ask, what percentage of my donation goes to the cause? We haven't been taught to ask, what good is the charity doing? So here's why the question is a bad one. Let's take two soup kitchens. One says 90% of your dollar goes back to the cause, and the other one you find out only 70 cents of your dollar goes back to the cause. So you give to the 90-cent soup kitchen. What if you actually went and visited the soup kitchens, and you find that the 90-cent soup kitchen is serving rancid soup in a dilapidated facility with a burnt-out staff? And the 70-cent soup kitchen is serving really hearty, nutritious soup in a state-of-the-art facility with a friendly staff that does case management. Well, now you'd want to give to the 70-cent soup kitchen. If all you asked was, what percentage of my donation is going to the cause, you would never have found that out. You would have given to the wrong soup kitchen.
Okay.
Also, when you ask that question, what percentage of my donation goes to the cause, you're discriminating unknowingly against causes that it's difficult to raise money for. So it's relatively easy to raise money for breast cancer. Unfortunately, many of us have lost friends to breast cancer. We're very ready to give to that cause. But take some obscure disease or a Native American addiction recovery clinic that is a lesser known cause. Well, that charity has to spend a lot of money to get somebody to give. They're not less efficient. They're not more wasteful. They're just less popular.
I mean, I think what you're saying right now is something I hadn't thought of before, which is basically that when you ask how much goes to the cause, you're ignoring how easy or hard it is to raise each dollar.
You're ignoring that, and you're ignoring what the charity's doing with the money. That's what you should be most concerned about, is what good is this charity doing? There was a fascinating study done for the Better Business Bureau by a Princeton research group, and they found that 73% of the public wants to know what percentage of their donation goes to the cause, but only 6% wanted to know if it makes a difference. Now, presumably, that's because we think it's the same thing. We've been so indoctrinated in that question that we think if it's a good answer, it's a good charity. That is not at all the case. It's like Richard Steinberg said, it's like trying to take the outside temperature by looking at your speedometer.
Right. Now, also, one thing you point out is that when you make that particular number, that particular measurement, the number one by so far as to how people determine who they're going to give to, then it will naturally fall, and you don't have to expand on this for sake of time, but it will naturally happen that charities begin to do some clever bookkeeping. If by describing more and more of their activities as being service provision, they can increase their percentage, then they're likely to do that, because you're not going to ask the second question, which is, can I see all the evidence that you have that percentage?
Absolutely. All these charities with all these seals of approval, you have no idea how they arrived at those numbers. But, you know, more important, what we're doing here by asking only that question is we're forcing charities to focus only on the answer to that
question. That's right.
So becoming, you know, getting a better efficiency number becomes the holy grail instead of trying to end poverty and trying to cure cancer and muscular dystrophy, which is what we should be supporting them and encouraging them to do. We're putting all of the wrong pressures on them. And so they get distracted, and, you know, it's no wonder we don't have a cure for cancer yet. We have great efficiency in our charities, or so we think. Well, that's because that's all we ever ask about, but we don't have a cure for cancer yet, and I think we'd rather have a cure for cancer. So, you know, it's not anybody's fault. It's just it's an old system. We got here by mistake, and now if we want to create real change in the world, we have to give charities different permissions. We have to start asking different questions.
Let me. I will. The book is uncharitable. And in it, you will find, we're not going to have time to deal with that, Dan's analysis of history of how you go back to the Puritans and you go back to the religious sacrifice involved in charity. And basically what you say, and I'll say it very quickly, is that you say that they had a thing where they were industrious in terms of making money. That was capitalism. That was Adam Smith. That was self-interest. And to account for that in a way, to balance the books with God, they would do charity. Hardly the same motivation. In other words, what you're saying is it wasn't the same impetus to solve those problems and achieve results there. It was one just to take care of their, to do penance in a way. Let me just finally ask, and I'll give you one minute, which is, I'm very sad. Besides what we've talked about in the larger picture, what could a listener do if they wanted to help this shift happen?
They should start asking different questions. Instead of asking what percentage of my donation goes to the cause, they should start asking what the charity's goals are, what the charity's dreams are, and how can I support you in achieving them. And they should start telling their friends, hey, we asked the wrong question about charity. Let's stop focusing on efficiency and start focusing on impact, because what we want is impact. And if you're not having an impact, you're not being very efficient anyway.
Okay. The book is Uncharitable, How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine the Potential. Author is Dan Pallotta, and the website is uncharitable.net. Let me say that again, uncharitable.net. Thank you, Dan Pallotta. Keep up the good work.